Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. In this hour, we talk about five big stories. First, 12 people were killed in a horrendous mass shooting at a bar in Southern California last night. Details are still emerging, but we have learned that the shooter was a 28-year-old combat veteran of the Marine Corps in Afghanistan. Next, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg fell and broke three ribs late last night. With conservative justices Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch in their 50s and Samuel Alito and John Roberts in their 60s, what could the court look like if Trump makes more appointments? Then, dangerous new anti-abortion ballot measures passed in Alabama and West Virginia this week, setting up for an intense and protracted court battle. Is the historic Roe v. Wade decision in jeopardy? And then, intense fighting took place last night in the province of Tikar in Afghanistan, killing 14 Afghan government soldiers. As the government loses ground, is there any hope for a negotiated peace? And finally, we continue with the second half of this week's regular segment, Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to another mass shooting in the United States. 12 people were killed in a horrendous mass murder at a bar in Southern California last night. Details are still emerging, but we have learned that the shooter, or the alleged shooter, has been identified as a 28-year-old veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps who served in Afghanistan. We're joined from Los Angeles by Mike Preisner. He is a U.S. veteran who served 4 years in the U.S. Army. He was part of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. He became an anti-war organizer within the U.S. military and among U.S. veterans. He is also a documentary filmmaker and a co-host of the anti-war podcast Eyes Left. Mike Preisner, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, you're in Southern California. You're in Virginia. Let's just start with what's the mood, what's the scene over there?
Well, Los Angeles, I'm just about 40 miles from where the shooting took place. And I have some friends in Ventura that I've been trying to check in with. But, you know, I mean, I think just watching the coverage, it's just such a routine, typical thing that people are just going through the same motions that they go through every time there's one of these. I think this is the second in 7 days.
Mike Preisner is our guest. Mike, you're right. I mean, mass shootings in America, and a mass shooting is defined as the shooting of four individuals or more in a single episode, that happens almost every day. So we're talking about a complicated, complex, and fairly common phenomena in American life. Even children, our kids, are when they go to school now, they're all going through drills of what to do in the event of a mass shooting or a shooter on campus. They're all learning how to you know, shelter down and protect themselves. I mean, it's pretty awful. And I don't want to oversimplify and try to understand this complex phenomena with sort of a trivialized or sort of superficial approach to it. But one of the things that is being discussed is the fact that this individual, the alleged shooter, was in fact a military veteran, somebody who was in Afghanistan. When you heard that, what did you think?
Well, I think in general, it's the easy answer to say it's the military churning these people out and that it's combat experience and PTSD that is what leads someone to become one of these mass shooter figures. But I think that, you know, that's not always correct. In fact, may not be correct at all. I think that, you know, there's many other factors for it. But I think that there's a common thread of mass shooters who have been in the military simply because the military is a very welcoming place for people with those types of tendencies. You know, it's kind of a first step for someone who wants to shoot people. I think the U.S. military and U.S. wars can be considered a contributing factor to mass shootings, whether or not you serve in the military. I mean, you're inundated with it constantly, with the glorification of the military, with fetishization of guns, of shooting people, this intense glorification of the rifleman. So that has an impact on society, whether or not you go into the military. And so it can't be a coincidence that the country engaged in the most killing around the world also experiences this unique mass shooting phenomenon. But we know mass shooters, whether or not they serve in the military, all of them are like obsessed with the military. And others just kind of live out their fantasies, cosplaying and buying a lot of guns and things like that. But of course, the military is a very welcoming place for people with this homicidal ideation or propensity for violence. But the root causes, of course, start long before you're old enough to join the military. But it's not surprising that many of these mass shooters are veterans, because the military is this natural first step for someone like this, especially when it can, you know, it's known to provide a space for people to live out these homicidal fantasies. And that's why even like the recruiting ads are targeted towards people who want to shoot guns and live out these, you know, action hero type violent fantasies.
Yeah, I'm really glad you made that point, Mike Pricer. And we have, let's just remind the audience, Secretary of Defense James Mattis, his nickname is Mad Dog, because at some point in his career, he said something like it was fun to shoot people. Almost every government, I would say, maybe with the exception of one or two, has a military. Some of the militaries are conscripted, some of them are volunteer. But in the case of the United States, it moved away from the conscripted army, the draft, because so many drafted people became, you know, very fierce opponents of the war in Vietnam. They were considered unreliable, politically, possibly dissidents. So the Pentagon moved to a different model of the volunteer army, but then it's always has to recruit, and it recruits because it incentivizes people, it gives them bonuses. But you're right, it also attracts us, or tries to attract, a certain type of people who would be like into the military. And you mentioned some of the advertising. I saw a particularly alarming U.S. Army ad. It was called Who We Are. It shows a squad of heavily armed soldiers. I saw this in the last week on TV. And they're moving through a village, a shooting seemingly at random into a Middle Eastern village. It looks like an Arab village. And it finally culminates in a huge explosion. I want to play, obviously we can't watch it. This is radio, not TV. It's a TV ad. I want to listen to just a little bit of the audio clip, though, and then get your reaction.
There are those who see the challenges facing the nation and say, send me. They fight for country. They fight for honor. They fight to win. Do you have what it takes?
Do you have what it takes? I mean, that's a direct, it's an amazing ad, right?
It is, you know, and it's couching itself in, oh, where this is about fighting for some greater cause. But the commercial very obviously is about the shooting and the explosions and the fight, right? I mean, these commercials are like a cause in themselves, right? I mean, we see these type of commercials now growing up every single day. So it's like this heavy worship of gun and military violence that these commercials, you know, play into. Then after a lifetime of this type of fetishization of this type of violence, then, you know, those commercials tell you that, well, if you want to shoot people with guns, here's a place to do that after, you know, spending many years, you know, showing you the images over and over on TV. But, you know, it's so deeply ingrained in our culture that even the coverage of the shooting seems to echo the same fetishization of guns in the military. So, like, what is the coverage all right now? It's footage of the SWAT officers with their assault rifles running around the building. It's 90% about this officer who was killed in the hail of bullets. You know, 12 people died, but you're only hearing about this officer who died shooting, the hero who ran in with the gun, that the only way you have this value is by being this soldier, being this action hero. So it's so deeply rooted in our culture that even during the tragedy itself, America cannot break its romanticization of guns and of violence.
And let's talk about a post-traumatic stress. Some of the media reports are suggesting that this veteran of the Marine Corps, I think he was a machine gunner, he served in Afghanistan at least one tour, that he had or was suffering from post-traumatic stress. Just talk about what that is and how many people it's impacted who served either in Iraq or Afghanistan or earlier in Vietnam.
Well, you know, for Iraq and Afghanistan, it's estimated that, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not a million, veterans who served suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. Of course, many millions from Vietnam. It's a cause of a really rampant suicide epidemic. But I think that, again, in the situation of mass shootings, it's, again, this easy answer, but not the answer. And in fact, I think in a lot of ways, it puts an unfair stigma on people with trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder, because post-traumatic stress disorder does not cause you to carry out a hateful, planned out, premeditated mass murder, right? If anyone with PTSD shoots and kills someone, it's because if it's caused by PTSD, it's because they're in a psychotic episode, they're hallucinating. It's not something like this where someone plans it, goes in somewhere and then kills a bunch of innocent people. So it kind of puts, like, it lacks the understanding of what actually post-traumatic stress disorder is. And as an unfair stigma on those who have it, and, you know, kind of obfuscates what's needed to treat it and actually the real root causes of what, you know, mass shootings are. And so I think a lot of will be made of that. He was in Afghanistan. He had PTSD. But I don't think either of those factors are what led him to do this. It was likely things that started long before. And this was just, you know, a stepping stone for him.
Yeah, I'm really glad you made that point, because, again, when people talk about PTSD or other kinds of mental illness, and then they link it to an individual who is engaged in a violent act, and say, well, of course, he was crazy or something like that, where, in fact, 99% of people who suffer from are impacted by mental illness or PTSD are not going in and carrying out premeditated murders. That's not the case at all. And many people, including people in the military, are, in fact, planning military operations right now that will carry out homicidal attacks on, say, villages in Yemen. Certainly that was the case with special operations. Nobody says, well, they did that because they're, quote, crazy or because they have PTSD. That's policy, and that's considered, you know, as long as it's organized, as long as it's state-sanctioned, that's cool.
Yeah, you know, and there is no doubt countless dead Iraqis and Afghans who were shot just walking down the street, just minding their own business, by people who joined the army because they had these sociopathic fantasies. And for many years, Iraq was essentially a shooting range for any of these terrible people who wanted to join and use it as such. But those periods are long gone. So I wouldn't be surprised if Ian David Long wasn't ever involved in any fighting. And so, you know, this idea that it was caused by his trauma or craziness from war, just like many of the mass shooters who were veterans, when actually looked in their military histories, they had never actually been in any combat or anything. So it just kind of explains, you know, it's not a cause. It's like, you know, this other coincidence, because people like this end up kind of trying to seek out their fantasies in the military as the ads coax them into doing.
Yeah. Mike Preisner is our guest. I'm so glad we're having this discussion, because people end up just reciting superficially the headlines that are sort of spoon-fed, the generalizations, not thinking, not going beneath the headlines to actually understand what's going on. Mike Preisner, you are the co-host of an anti-war podcast specifically oriented towards, although not exclusively oriented towards, active duty soldiers, Marines, sailors, and veterans, and of course, anybody who believes in peace. Talk about, in our last 30 seconds, the podcast Eyes Left and how people can find it.
Sure. Well, I host it with Afghanistan veteran Spencer Rapone, who was recently kicked out of the army for revealing a Che Guevara shirt in his West Point uniform. But, you know, the two of us started this podcast hoping to reach the soldiers who are in the military, who, of course, don't like Trump, disagree with U.S. wars, and many of the other things that we're seeing in general society that, of course, are reflected within the military. And so that's it's Eyes Left Podcast. It's on any streaming platform, or you can find us at Eyes Left Pod on any social media.
Okay, we'll leave it there. We were joined from Los Angeles by Mike Preisner. Mike is a U.S. military veteran. He served 4 years in the Army. He was part of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. He became an important part of the anti-war movement, organizing anti-war GIs and active duty members of the U.S. Armed Forces. He's also a documentary filmmaker and the co-host of the podcast we mentioned, Eyes Left. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg fell and broke three ribs last night, with conservative justices Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch in their 50s and Samuel Alito and John Roberts in their 60s. What could the court look like if the Trump administration is able to make more appointments in the coming months or years? We're joined in studio by Deborah Golden. She is an attorney with the Human Rights Defense Center and a national expert in prisoner human rights litigation. Deborah, welcome to Loud and Clear.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg is obviously hurt. She's not necessarily seriously hurt. We don't know. We don't really know what her prognosis is. But of course, during the past few years, especially when she got older, and also when it became clear that she and a few other Supreme Court justices would at some point be retiring from the court, some point leaving the court, it raises the question, who will replace them? Barack Obama was able to nominate two Supreme Court justices. Well, he nominated three, but the third was sidelined a year before the election. Now we have Donald Trump. Anyway, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, considered a prominent liberal on the court, her replacement, for whatever reason, by a Trump nominee, it would be important.
It would be important. Justice Ginsburg is considered the most liberal member of the court by most measures, respected by many. She's had a long and storied legal career. She is, of course, 85 and eventually will leave the court. If Trump appoints somebody else, in addition to Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh, we could probably assume they would have views closer to the two justices he's already appointed than that of Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Right. So, I mean, here's the situation in the United States. We have a representative democracy. We vote every 2 years for 435 members of the House of Representatives. We vote every 2 or 4 or 6 years for U.S. senators, the American version of the House of Lords. These senators serve 6-year terms. Both of those bodies, legislative bodies, are considered checks and balances against each other because both have to agree before something becomes a law. And of course, then the president has to sign it. But then you have the third leg of the constitutional government, which is the Supreme Court, appointed for life.
Right.
Not elected.
Confirmed by the Senate.
Confirmed by the Senate. Okay. But they have a lot of power. And if you look through American history, there have been a lot of bad Supreme Court decisions. There have been a couple good ones, and people who are on the left sort of emphasize the good ones. But when you look at the track record over, say, since 1803 and the Mayberry decision, a lot of bad decisions.
There have been a lot of decisions that have been criticized by parties on all sides of the aisle. It's tempting, I think, to divide decisions into liberal and conservative, to divide justices into liberal and conservative. But of course, they all have complex visions of what the proper role of government is. And they do have incredible power. They are 9 individuals who serve for life or until they decide to retire and greatly shape the course of American law.
Is it too much power?
I don't know. I think that's a possibility that some people have raised. On the other hand, the role and supremacy of the courts is one of the things that America prides itself on.
So Ruth Bader Ginsburg could have retired during the Obama years. He was there for 8 years. Even by then, she was quite elderly. I know there were a lot of people in liberal and progressive circles who thought, why not retire now when Barack Obama is president? Thus, the next justice replacing her would be, if not as left or as liberal as Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And she's not, you know, in some areas, she's not that liberal. She was very highly critical of Colin Kaepernick, for instance, called his taking the knee protest dumb and ridiculous or something like that. But by relative standards, she is to the left, as you said. And these are weighty decisions where somebody has to think about, well, if I don't resign now, if I resign under the next term, the whole political nature of the court could be skewed. And then you have civil rights at stake, women's rights at stake, LGBTQ rights at stake, workers' rights at stake. I mean, it seems to me to have such a preponderant influence in the American body politic.
It does. And many of our decisions that we make in this country are decided in the courts. Some would say that is because of log jams in the other branches of government. It's hard to say with hindsight what Ruth Bader Ginsburg should have or could have done. Of course, as you mentioned, Merrick Garland, who Obama appointed, didn't have a hearing for a year and was not confirmed, which led to Trump appointing Justice Gorsuch.
Deborah Golden is our guest. Deborah, let's talk about Donald Trump and his strategy right now. We just had the midterm elections. The Senate majority for the Republicans expanded. That's the body within the U.S. legislative branch that actually approves judicial nominees. Donald Trump made a point, really, of focusing his campaigning around senatorial candidates, both for Republicans and against Democrats. And his argument has been, and some of his most conservative backers' argument has been, that the control of the Senate is all important, that the House of Representatives, actually, big talk shop, maybe won't do anything. Maybe nobody will even notice if they don't do anything. But the Senate has this power of confirming judges. And compared to Obama and compared to earlier presidents, Donald Trump has made the appointment of justices that he wants and that the Federalist Society wants, that the right wing wants, a very top priority. It appears that he may succeed in this.
It does. He's certainly appointed a large number of justices for any president in the first 2 years of their term. Control of the Senate is something that has been important to him. I believe we're still waiting on a few races to be called as we're talking here today, so we don't know exactly how large the Republican majority will be. And of course, some appointments are not controversial by any means and are overwhelmingly approved. So we don't know. But we do know that when he campaigned, he released a list of what he called his short list of justices, of people that he would consider for justices. And they all tend to be on the more conservative side of the political spectrum, approved by the Federalist Society.
Deborah Golden is our guest. I want to go back over some of the awful Supreme Court decisions. I don't know. I'm against the Supreme Court, just so you know. I'm in that Eugene Debs socialist school. Debs ran in 1912 on the platform that the Senate should be abolished and that the Supreme Court should be abolished, that they were two sort of monarchical forms of government antithetical to representative democracy. But you had the Dred Scott decision in 1857. That decision said that there's no rights that African-American people have that white people have to respect. It meant that slavery could be, in the reach of slavery, could be extended even into non-slave states in the North. The failure to uphold the Civil Rights Act of 1863, then the Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, which upheld basically apartheid in America, separate but equal, so-called. Lots of decisions like that. And then when you think about when the Supreme Court actually did progressive things, like in the 1930s, upholding workers' right to unionize, upholding the right of to have for FDR to have unemployment insurance or Social Security, or later the Brown versus Board of Education in the early 1950s that outlawed segregation in public schools. Those times when the court was actually doing something progressive, it was because there was a lot of progressive grassroots mass movements at play. The court, as John Roberts said, we're like an umpire behind the plate. We call balls and strikes. In other words, nothing political. That's not true, though, is it?
I think that many court observers, myself included, would find that that is a bit simplistic, and that while judges and justices do try to make the right decision as they see it, everyone is driven by their own perspectives and politics, whether in the forefront of their mind or just in the experiences that they bring with them to the bench.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We were joined in studio by Deborah Golden. Deborah is an attorney with the Human Rights Defense Center and a national expert in prisoner human rights litigation. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. A dangerous new anti-abortion ballot measure was passed in Alabama and in West Virginia this week, setting up for intense court battles and grassroots organizing. Is Roe v. Wade in jeopardy? Are women's rights to control their own body at play now, not only in Alabama, but throughout the South and throughout the country? We're joined from Montgomery, Alabama, by Mia Raven. She is an advocate for women at the Reproductive Health Services of Montgomery Abortion Clinic. She is the co-founder of the nonprofit next door to the clinic called Powerhouse, People Organizing for Women's Empowerment and Rights. Mia, welcome to Loud and Clear.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us, first of all, what did the ballot measure actually stipulate, and does it have the force of law?
Well, the ballot measure stipulates that Alabama women will have no right to an abortion or rights to funding for abortion in the state of Alabama. Right now, we are protected by Roe and, you know, latterly, and Casey as well. But if Roe were to fall, then Alabama would become a state where you would not be able to get abortion care. And it has no exceptions whatsoever for the life of the mother or for rape or incest, things like that.
What was the vote? How did it turn out?
It was about 60-40. We had a lot of ballot measures here in Alabama. We also had a kind of ridiculous Ten Commandments ballot measure. It was just made to get people out to the polls because even in Alabama, you know, midterms are historically lower for turnout. And it was just, here we are. It's Alabama.
Yeah. No, I hear you. But certainly it was designed to pull conservative voters or people for whatever reason, religious conviction or political bias or bigotry, whatever. We don't have to go over all the different reasons why someone might oppose abortion rights or women's right to control their own bodies. Okay, it was designed to sort of bring those voters to the polls. But and from a practical point of view, does it have an immediate impact on your work or those other clinics? And I don't really know if you'd help us understand how many clinics or hospitals or doctor's offices are actually providing abortion services?
Right now in Alabama, we have 3 clinics remaining. All of us are independent providers. Most of our doctors here, they come from out of state. There are very few doctors in state who will do abortion care. It has no immediate effect other than confusing our patients. Most of yesterday was spent even at all 3 clinics. I've talked to everyone, you know, because there's not that many of us. And they said all day yesterday they just fielded calls wanting to know if abortion was still legal. Were we going to be open? Could they come in this week? They didn't know what was going to go on. Right now it has no effect as of this moment, but I don't put anything past the Alabama legislature, and we will be back in session, you know, after the beginning of the year. So right now we're good, but that could change in a heartbeat.
Alabama's a big state. 3 clinics or offices providing abortion services, that's pretty minuscule.
It is. Mississippi is down to 1, 2. Louisiana is also down to 3. Providers in the South, they're under attack. 3 clinics for the whole state of Alabama. Currently, we are the only clinic between Tampa, Florida, and Jackson, Mississippi. If that gives you any kind of readout as far as, we have women coming 3 to 5, 6, 7 hours away to see us here in Montgomery.
Working class women in particular, poor women, low income people from low income families, having to travel long distances, it's hugely problematic. And there are other constraints and restraints that are imposed on people. Are there other in other states? What's the situation in Alabama? Is there a waiting period? Do people have to come once and then come back, and et cetera?
Yes. Alabama has a 48-hour waiting period. So you have to make 2 visits in person. We can't mail you materials. We can't do any of that. We have to see you in person. 2 visits. So yeah, that really puts women out, when, especially when they're low income and they already have children, because most of the women we see, they do have a family already. And it really creates a lot of barriers for them to access care and actually causes them to go later in the term to get their procedure done versus being able to do it earlier because of the waiting and having to arrange for childcare and work, you know, problems, things like that. People don't think about that, but that really impacts women a lot.
It certainly must. Mia Raven is our guest. Mia is an advocate for women at the Reproductive Health Services of Montgomery Abortion Clinic. She is also the co-founder of the nonprofit next door to the clinic called Powerhouse, People Organized for Women's Empowerment and Rights. Mia, when we look at the big picture right now, obviously abortion rights and people, healthcare professionals providing abortion services have been targeted by right-wing political organizations and right-wing political demagogues. I just wonder, what's it like for you from a point of view of personal safety or safety for your clinic, and what security measures do you have to take?
Well, I'm very hesitant to talk about our security, but we take security very seriously here. Last summer, a candidate for the Attorney General for Alabama actually doxed one of our physicians. That was not great. They put all their information out online, suggested that she should be charged with murder. And I've had death threats personally. My escorts have had, threats against their lives. It's something we take seriously, especially here in the South. one of our doctors previously that went to Pensacola, he was killed in Pensacola, Dr. Gunn. He worked here at this clinic. So security is something that we have always taken very, very seriously here.
What happened to Dr. Gunn?
He was walking into the clinic, and as he was walking in, someone shot him in the back 3 times.
Yeah, and what year was that?
That was 1993, I believe.
Yeah, I remember it, but vaguely now because it was 25 years ago. I mean, it's been a reign of terror. This is terrorism directed against those who are seeking healthcare services, abortion, or against healthcare professionals. But, you know, when you think about what happens to abortion clinics and healthcare professionals providing abortion services for women, which is the law of the land, Roe v. Wade is the law of the land, you know, it's a form of terrorism. It is terrorism, but it's never called that. I mean, or rarely called that, at least in the mainstream media. Why is that?
I have no idea. I've always called it terrorism. Some people call it domestic terrorism. I call it plain terrorism because, I mean, that's what it is. Maybe because of the religious aspect to it. A lot of people, you know, who protest here, they believe that they're doing something, you know, in the eyes of their God that would be okay. But I really don't. That's a great question. I really wish I had a better answer for you. But to me, it is terrible.
Yeah, I hear you. Mia Raven is our guest. Mia, and we're talking to her from Montgomery, Alabama. Mia, when people are coming to the clinic for abortion services, now you're talking about low-income women, in many cases, coming long distances, then they have to come back 48 hours later. The idea that you can make abortion go away, that's unreal, right? I mean, that's a fantasy. Women who want to have abortions will have abortions. The question is whether the abortions are legal, whether the abortions are safe. If absent the right to abortion or access to abortion, a lot of women are going to die as a lot of women used to die because they're going to have back alley procedures. I mean, that's really the issue right now in America, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Just because you make abortion illegal does not stop it. Talk to anyone who was around pre-Roe days. And talk to them about sepsis wards in hospitals. People of a certain age who are OBGYNs will tell you sometimes that they got into OBGYN care because of what was happening to women. Making abortion legal does not stop abortion. It just stops safe abortion for women. And women will die. This is not rhetoric. It is the truth because women will do what they have to do.
Mia Raven, one last question. There's the technology of Plan B over-the-counter medicine in some areas. That's true in Washington, D.C., where women who believe that they have an unwanted pregnancy can, by taking a pill, basically guarantee that they won't have an unwanted pregnancy. Is a Plan B medication available in the state of Alabama?
Yes, it is over-the-counter. You have to be at least 15 years old to access that. That is the only age restriction we have, but it is over-the-counter in Alabama, and anyone can go into a pharmacy and pick that up.
And do you think, given the restraints and sort of extreme pressure on abortion clinics, that this will become the option for more and more women, girls and women?
I think it will, but the problem in Alabama that we have is education. A lot of women, we don't teach sex ed in schools. And what we do teach in very limited in Alabama is often not scientifically correct. I'm afraid that, you know, women will take it incorrectly. They won't know that they have to take it within so many hours of unprotected sex. Or they might not know that if they weigh a certain amount, that one pill may not be efficient for them. They may need a different brand of pill that is made for them if they're over a certain weight. It's going to be tough if this goes into effect because you're not going to stop women from trying to have an abortion or get emergency contraception. It's just going to be a point of how many women are going to be hurt trying to get the care that they need that they can't access legally and safely.
I'm glad you put it that way. It's not about the so-called right to life. It's about how many women's lives will be ended or harmed and how many women will be made unsafe. That's the issue. Anyway, Mia Raven is our guest. She's an advocate for women at the Reproductive Health Services of Montgomery Abortion Clinic, the co-founder of the nonprofit next door to the clinic called Powerhouse, People Organizing for Women's Empowerment and Rights. Mia Raven, to you and to the other healthcare professionals, we just want to say, at least here in Washington, D.C., we want to express our solidarity with you and, of course, with the women whose rights are being snatched away or attempted to be snatched away by these political demagogues. So thank you very, very much for joining Loud and Clear.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Stay with us. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Intense fighting took place last night in the province of Takhar, killing 14 Afghan government soldiers. As the Afghan government loses ground, is there any hope for a negotiated peace? We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Dr. Marvin Weinbaum. Dr. Weinbaum is a scholar in residence and the director of the Middle East Institute Center for Pakistan and Afghanistan Studies. Marvin Weinbaum, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you.
I'm looking at different media outlets. Here's one, Business Insider headline, sort of typical. The headline reads, "The war in Afghanistan looks bleak as the government loses more control and Afghan security forces casualties rise." Is that, outside of being typical, is it accurate?
Yes, I'm afraid it is. There has been a spate of attacks on police stations, on any kind of concentration of security forces. And lately, the pace of this has really risen considerably. You know, at the same time that they're talking about or looking for signs of progress towards peace, the level of violence is increasing. Not that the Taliban are taking and holding territory, but I don't think that's their intention at this time.
Dr. Marvin Weinbaum is our guest. I'm looking also now at Al Jazeera. The headline, "Russia to host talks with Afghan leaders, Taliban delegation. Representatives from the Afghan government and the Taliban's political office in Doha will attend talks on November 9th. That's now. So what's that? I mean, is it possible that there could be real peace negotiations, and is it possible that they could be happening without the U.S. government part of them?
Well, I don't. It's happening without without a high level Afghan delegation. Now, actually, the peace group, peace council, higher peace council, as it's called, is represented there, but officially, the government is keeping a little distance. No, I don't think that these talks should be taken too seriously. They are meant to be groundbreakers to simply get some kind of dialogue going. There's not going to be any negotiations, but it is a show. Basically, the Russian government would like to take the lead here. And as they do that, they take the initiative away from the U.S. efforts, which have been focused in Doha. So I think we ought to see this as a certainly in some ways a positive development, but not in any way a serious step toward a real negotiations toward peace.
The Russian Foreign Ministry said that it had invited several other countries to send representatives, including India, Iran, Pakistan, China, and the United States. Will the other countries arrive? The talks are scheduled to begin tomorrow.
You know, I'm not certain about that. I think the Pakistanis will be there, and that's very important. They had indicated that they would attend. But about the others, I rather doubt that if the U.S. isn't there, that the Indians will be there. I hadn't heard about an Iranian decision on that. But again, the broader the attendees, that would speak well for at least broadening the dialogue here and basically getting something going, which very likely what this will end with is a decision, as these meetings always do, and the only important decision, and that is, let's meet again. But some would say, well, that's better than fighting, except that the fighting is going on, and it's going on at, I say, a very high level of intensity.
Dr. Marvin Weinbaum is our guest. We're talking about the deteriorating situation militarily for the Afghan government in the Afghan war. Dr. Weinbaum, this for America, this war has gone on since October 7th, 2001. So, you know, we've passed the 17-year mark. Not, of course, the same level of military engagement that the U.S. had earlier or after President Obama came into office when he did the troop surge and sent tens of thousands more troops to Afghanistan for a limited amount of time. Now it appears that U.S. troops are playing more or less a support role for the Afghan military. Yet the situation has deteriorated. I wonder under these circumstances whether the Taliban, who seem not to be able to win the war, but certainly they can't be defeated either. Will they just decide, look, we can wait this out. We are engaged in a long-term war. Even before 2001, the Taliban was involved in war with other factions of warlords inside of Afghanistan. And before that, as some of them, at least as part of the Mujahideen against the old socialist government in Afghanistan and their Soviet allies, will they just decide, hey, we're kind of winning, we can't win yet, but we can just wait them out? Is that their attitude?
I think indeed that is their strategy. They have never suggested to anyone that they're in a rush. Now, this doesn't mean that they aren't taking casualties themselves, and they're exhausted. But you could say that the Afghan National Security Forces are even more exhausted. And there is a strong push here in Afghanistan by the people who are, you know, fatigued after not just these 17 years, but one way or another, Afghanistan has been at war since 1978, almost continuously.
That's 40 years.
Yes, over this period of time. And so there certainly is a strong lobby here for peace. Now, peace on what terms? If the Kabul government was, say, you know, let's have talks, and the Taliban responded, and the Afghan government, of course, is pressing hard for talks, and if the response from the Taliban was, yes, let's sit down and talk under these conditions, that the discussions will be on our terms, not your terms. They won't be about how you can fit us into your constitutional, pluralistic, at least informed democratic system, but rather how we can find a place for you, accommodate you in an Islamic emirate. Because that really, for the leadership, is their goal. And it's been their goal all along, and that's why we've never gotten even past that first step of agreeing to talk. All of the discussion that's going on is shadow boxing around the fact that there's around the objective here of just getting people to sit down. Well, the Taliban will sit down with the Americans, because in sitting down with the Americans now, the Taliban really want three things. They want legitimacy, and they're getting that. The meeting in Moscow is for them a real victory, in that it provides the legitimacy, which puts them on the same in the same status in a way as the Afghan government. So legitimacy is objective. They want very much to see the release of hundreds of prisoners. This has always been high on their agenda. They said, we won't talk unless you release prisoners. And back when there were the last formal talks, and it didn't last long, in Doha some 4 years ago, in order to get the talks going, the U.S. had to give up five people from Guantanamo. Well, irony here, those five people are in Doha now. And so the future talks with the Americans will include the very people who were surrendered to the Taliban in order to get talks going in the past.
And President Obama paid a heavy price politically for that move.
He did, because we had released this Bergdahl fellow from who had deserted, and he was certainly not a poster child for the way the U.S. military wanted to be thought of.
Dr. Weinbaum, we have 1 minute left, so you were going on to your third point before I interrupted you.
The third is the most important. They want to talk to the Americans because the Americans are the people they want to see leave. And so trying to get the U.S., induce the U.S. to leave, is really at the most important thing of their objectives. And therefore, you don't talk to the Kabul government, and they're not, but you talk to the Americans. So it really stops with that. And again, I think even if we got past those three things, that the U.S. said, well, we might under certain conditions leave, even if we did that, then the real hard problem of what it is that we can actually agree on for the future of Afghanistan.
That was the voice of Dr. Marvin Weinbaum. We talked to Dr. Weinbaum from Washington, D.C. He is a scholar in residence and director of the Middle East Institute Center for Pakistan and Afghanistan Studies. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Today we're joined in a special segment by Kevin Camps. Kevin normally speaks to Loud and Clear every Wednesday in a segment called Beyond Nuclear, but we're taking an in-depth look at the impact of the midterm elections on nuclear issues, including nuclear power, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and nuclear technology. Kevin Camps, welcome back.
Thanks, Brian.
Kevin, in our last segment, the one we talked about on Wednesday, we talked about the impact of the midterm elections, and in particular, the gubernatorial outcome in New Mexico, perhaps a major shift in terms of political leadership that has potentially a profound impact on the issue of New Mexico as the world's nuclear waste dump. Let's talk about what happened in Nevada.
Well, on election night on Tuesday, Jackie Rosen, the Democratic congresswoman from Southern Nevada, defeated Dean Heller, the incumbent Republican U.S. senator, for that seat. And that's a big deal because, you know, the first thing to say about Nevada is almost everybody, bipartisan, Republican, Democrat, is opposed to the Yucca Mountain dump, which is a proposal for 70,000 tons of high-level radioactive waste from both the commercial nuclear power industry, atomic reactors for electricity, and also the nuclear weapons complex. And so it is bipartisan opposition. There are exceptions. The counties out there are blinded by radioactive dollar signs. There's a lot of Republicans out in rural Nevada. So there's some exceptions to that. So Dean Heller, to give him credit, has been a leader in the U.S. Senate against the Yucca dump. But now you've got two Democratic U.S. senators from Nevada. The other one is Catherine Cortez Masto. So it's going to be an interesting dynamic in the Senate now that you have, like I haven't seen probably in 20 years. That was 20 years ago when there were two U.S. senators who were Democrats from Nevada fighting the Yucca dump. So here we go again. The thing now, though, is that they're both relatively new. Cortez Masto just got elected last cycle, and now Jackie Rosen will take her seat in January. And in the Senate, the way it works is seniority. And so we'll see what they're able to accomplish with their new lock on power in Nevada.
And what would you want them to accomplish?
Oh, well, Nevada for 30 years now has led in the country warning people about what it means to open a high-level radioactive waste dump. It means we all live in Nevada when it comes to the transportation of these forever deadly and high-risk high-level radioactive wastes. And so I hope they will continue, and I know they will, I'm sure they will, continue to educate not only their own constituents, but the rest of the country that you better be careful what you wish for. If you vote in favor of the Yucca dump, this stuff's probably going to be coming through your congressional district. So we'll see that continued from Nevada. On the governor's race on election night, the Democrat won, beat the Republican. It was an open seat. And interestingly, the Republican, Laxalt, is the son of Domenici, who died last year, a Republican senator from New Mexico, who was very pro-nuclear, the most pro-nuclear member of the U.S. Senate of the last generation, Pete Domenici. Well, Laxalt is his son and lost. And so the Democrat will take the governor's seat and will direct the state agency for nuclear projects is an arm of the governor's office, and they lead the fight against the yucca dump. So it's an interesting consolidation of power by the Democrats in Nevada. There are Republican allies at various levels in the state, county, you know, levels who are also opposed to the dump. So I look forward to, you know, we've worked with Nevada for a long time fighting this dump. So I look forward to that bipartisan cooperation. But the Democrats are now ascendant in Nevada, and they will lead this fight for, you know, the next couple plus years.
When we look at the election outcome, you can't but help come to the conclusion that America is a divided country. I mean, it's divided in numerous ways. It's not simply the Russians dividing us, Kevin, as the assertion goes. People are divided based on race, but we see really a division based on urban and rural voters and their outlooks. 81% of the American people live in an urban environment, meaning in a city or in a close by suburb. There's in many ways disproportionate political power exercised by the more rural sectors of society as a consequence of the way the system, the federal system, is set up. But here you take an issue like nuclear power, nuclear waste. Of course, all parts of the population are propagandized to, especially by the nuclear industry. But people in rural areas in particular, or small towns in particular, people in Western states in particular, not only are living around nuclear dumps like Yucca Mountain or what's being suggested and proposed in New Mexico, they're also the ones who are going to suffer from it. When you talk about political cooperation, it would seem like the nuclear issue could be one of those issues where voters, be they Republican, so-called the red state, red supporters, or blue Democrats, there might be a point of commonality, because guess what? They're human beings who are going to be negatively, catastrophically impacted by these technologies.
There's a lot of folks in Nevada and downwind in Utah, Mormon Republicans, who get that very much so, because they suffered tremendously from the radioactive fallout from nuclear weapons testing in Nevada. And in my mind, and I've been doing this for 25 plus years, that's a big part of the resistance in Nevada and Utah to the Yucca Mountain dump. And there was a interim storage site targeted at Utah 15 years ago at an Indian reservation called Skull Valley. People's attitude is, you know what? We've taken one for the team. We have suffered significantly from cancers and deaths and other diseases caused by radioactive fallout from the Nevada test site. And so what does the U.S. federal government do? They choose the edge of the Nevada test site for the radioactive waste dump for the country at Yucca Mountain. And something I'd like to add, you mentioned rural Nevada, but it's also applicable to urban Nevada, is the Western Shoshone Indians and other indigenous peoples out there. I mentioned the Skull Valley Goshutes. There's the Southern Paiutes. They, too, are opposed to the Yucca Mountain dump, just like they were opposed to nuclear weapons testing in Nevada. And it's their land by treaty right. You know, they've been out there since time immemorial. The treaty is called the Treaty of Ruby Valley, a peace and friendship treaty between the Western Shoshone Indians and the U.S. government that was signed in 1863. And of course, as with many, most, all treaties, the U.S. government violated the treaty before the ink was dry. But in this particular case, there's a group out there called the Native Community Action Council. And its secretary is Ian Zabardi, a Western Shoshone principal man, a leader of their nation. And they are a party to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission licensing proceeding on the Yucca dump. And their contentions include the fact that they have the treaty. And this land and this water is theirs by treaty right. That's a problem. The U.S. government can't prove title to the land where they want to dump the country's radioactive waste. So hats off to the Western Shoshone for leading the resistance to weapons testing and radioactive waste dumping for more than a generation.
And that's important, too, because even delay makes a difference. Whatever means are available to stop something from being established, whatever legal means are available, and certainly title seems to be very much at the center of any legal dispute in America's legal system and the system of contracts. Yeah, that would slow things down. And slowing things down is important, because once the thing happens, it's happened. And having time means that there's time to organize. It seems to me that this is one of those issues, while it was very dominant in the late 1970s after Three Mile Island, and certainly again after Chernobyl in 1986, it's laid dormant for a while. but it has the potential to come back. Hopefully, it won't be because of America's Fukushima or another Three Mile Island or America's Chernobyl before that becomes the big wake-up call. In other words, there needs to be emergency action and mass action at the grassroots level now before a catastrophe wakes the country up.
And, you know, the issue that Nevada, including Democrat and Republican politicians like Harry Reid, the retired Democratic leader of the Senate, have made prominent in this issue is the mobile Chernobyl, the Fukushima freeways, the floating Fukushimas, the dirty bombs on wheels. This transport risk issue is everybody's problem.
Because the nuclear waste, if it's coming from all over the country, east, west, north, south, it has to get to these parking lot dumps somehow. That's by train or by truck.
And even by barges on surface waters. And Nevada, to its credit, has done incredible scholarship. The current director of the state agency, Robert Halstead, they've literally written reams on these risks.
1 minute left, Kevin. We've been talking about Western states. Let's talk about Tennessee. What's new?
Well, one thing that's new is there's real pushback against the nuclear weapons complex in this country from expanding its operations. And so the Oak Ridge Environmental Peace Alliance is leading the fight in the country to stop the uranium production facility, a key ingredient in nuclear weapons. And they're doing tremendous work at all times, but especially on this front.
That's Kevin Camps. Go to his website, beyondnuclear.org, not only to find out what Kevin's saying with the writings of the organization, but most importantly, get involved with an organization that's trying to do something about nuclear power, nuclear waste, nuclear technologies, nuclear weapons. Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear, will join Loud and Clear again next Wednesday, as he does every Wednesday, to discuss these issues. We'll be back tomorrow. We're all out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM or 1390 AM. You can hear us live every day, 4 to 6 p.m. at SputnikNews.com. You can subscribe as a podcast at iTunes Radio, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and now you can hear us at Spotify. You can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear. Thank you.